Hello and welcome to Connections. This is a special Friday edition of our program here on MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, joined by Rick Moore. And Rick, hello and welcome.
Hello there. Yeah, this is special for a Friday and looking forward to it. Great to have all these people getting us information, and it's very great that they will be, you know, are willing to do this. So another big shoe.
You got it. We added one last weekend, a Connections show. We're on Tuesday and Thursday mornings with Josh Arnold, and now we add a Friday bonus edition of the program. And as folks can see, our guests include Sheriff Kevin Coppinger, Essex County Sheriff Coppinger. Lots of great information, really interesting stuff coming up with the sheriff here just ahead. We have Mayor Kim Driscoll from the city of Salem. We also have Tim Kearns in the beer pond. And what else do we have, Rick?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that kind of knocks me off my feet right there. We'll be talking with Gloucester Fire Department's Chief Eric Smith. And Chief Smith goes into detail about so many things, about how the fire department is responding, how they're taking care of calls, taking care of themselves as well. So it's a very informative interview with Chief Smith.
Interesting stuff. And by the way, we're doing a lot of this stuff. We're reacting to trying to present information about how the North Shore is reacting and connecting you with what we think are great people doing great work on the North Shore. And so that's what we're doing this for. You know, we haven't really been doing a lot. You know, Rick, we haven't done a lot of medical information because neither you or I are trained in the medical profession, if I remember right. You're not, right, Rick?
No. I did the ABCD basic training when I was in the Army. That's about it.
I know that if you cut yourself, you need a Band-Aid or you need to put something on there, you know, but yeah.
I go back to Mercurochrome. You ever heard of that?
No, I've heard of that, yeah.
Okay, well, that's my training.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, if it can't be dealt with by a tourniquet, count us out. I was in Boy Scouts, so I remember learning how to do a tourniquet, too.
But you know, on the the serious side of this, Bill, my stepdaughter is a nurse, and I know that your wife is a nurse, and they are involved. It's funny, I saw something on some post somewhere or an interview that one of the doctors or nurses said, we don't like to be referred to as being on the front lines because we are your last resort. However, the front lines, meaning that they're out there in the battlefield while we're staying at home, and the appreciation. I don't think it can be measured, Bill, on what they're doing, and you're close to it, I'm close to it. Just the compassion, the professionalism, and the anxiety to some extent is something that in my lifetime I've never seen. I know that the generation before us did during World War II, but I think this may be on a par with that to some extent.
Well, there's clearly anxiety, and with the folks, and rightfully so, with those people on. Well, I'll still call it the front line, to be honest with you. I think that that's still probably pretty appropriate here. Rick, any other notices from around towns? I mean, we're seeing that basically all cities and towns, you know, in our area are all kind of doing all the same things as far as the social distancing, the closing of playgrounds, the closing of public buildings and other buildings and so on, the, you know, non-essential businesses being shut down and so on, working from home, less traffic, all of that. But from town to town, once in a while, we do get a few notes and we like to pass them on.
I think that's what's encouraging, Bill, is the message is pretty much the same in all the communities that we have visited via the phone or via, email and online. And that is that, number one, what you just said, the physical distancing, the people staying at home, going out when they need to, being very cognizant of the panic buying needs to stop, and that's in the past, hopefully. But also the message that the public officials are conveying to us is the fact that there are so many people cooperating in so many ways. And plus, businesses that have gone offline and are losing a lot of revenue at this point are still going out of their way to try to help others, and whether it's, you know, making masks or whether it's delivering food, whatever it might be, that's consistent across the North Shore in every town we've talked with, in every city we've talked with.
Yeah, I wanted to share one note here. One of our clients, if you will, is Sylvan Street Grill, Bradford Tavern, and I did get word, and I was wondering about the Sylvan Street Grill, that the Sylvan Street Grill is open for takeout Monday through Friday, so today, till 8 o'clock, 4 until 8. So those are short hours, but they're the key hours, 4 to 8, Monday through Friday, and then on Saturday and Sunday over the weekend from 12 to 8. So just keep them in mind, the Sylvan Street Grill for takeout. Always a great place to meet, to chill, and so on. But now you just have to chill outside, I guess, like with every other restaurant. But when you go into Sylvan Street Grill, tell them we sent you, and do go in there. And I know folks are looking. Some places are closed, but we just definitely hope that you do check out the Sylvan Street Grill and so on in the days ahead.
I miss our business meetings there, to be sure, Bill. no doubt. But, you know, if you can safely visit or avail yourself to the many different places around the North Shore that are open for takeout, then that helps support the community as well. Bill, I have one note that we got from the Manchester-by-the-Sea Police Department Chief Todd Fitzgerald, if I could mention that.
I would say that would be fine.
All right, let's do it. Police Chief Todd Fitzgerald would like to announce School Resource Officer Andrea Locke will be hosting a virtual story time for elementary students while school buildings remain closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, these sessions will be cast live on the police department's Facebook page at 10 a.m. each Friday, starting Friday, today. Mm-hmm. These storylines will be held every Friday until schools reopen for students. And the chief is quoted as saying, "Reading aloud to students is a great way our department can engage with some of the youngest residents in our community during this challenging, uncertain time surrounding the novel coronavirus pandemic. We look forward to hosting these sessions as a way to bring residents together while most people are social distancing and following the stay-at-home advisory, and we hope that families will join us." So another innovative procedure by the Manchester-by-the-Sea Police Department.
You know, I just happened to think of a feature that we could run here on the website, Rick, is I have a number of young children's storybooks in our possession at our house here. And I'm thinking, how great would that be to share a picture book with the folks every day here on the website, huh?
that would be cool, but that's way beyond my child-rearing time. I don't have any of those books left.
Well, we still do. I know that, but for the next generation, if you will, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's Friday, and we're getting ready for the weekend, and weekends look like weekdays nowadays for everybody as well. But I guess again, just isolate, stay safe, and all of that. And I want you to hang tight and enjoy the program coming up. We got some great guests coming up on the program. Anything else from you, Rick, or thoughts or suggestions for the weekend?
Well, I just think the consistent message from me that going through my head is just to be patient and do the right thing. I, to this point, and I don't want to jinx anything, but to this point, it's I only know a couple of people who've been infected, only one seriously, and hopefully he's on the mend, although it's touch and go at the moment. But I think if we can be patient, and thank God for all those essential workers who are out there who supply our food, our electricity, our water, and so on, and our safety. As long as we have that and we're safe in our own homes, then we just have to be patient.
Gotcha. Well, Rick, what we'll do is we'll step aside for some messages, and we'll be back with guests. Again, Sheriff Kevin Coppinger from the Essex County Sheriff's Office, Mayor Kimberly Driscoll from Salem, and Tim Kearns with the beer pot at the end of the program, and also Eric Smith from the Gloucester Fire Department. Does that sound right?
That sounds good. It sounds perfect. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I should at least be able to get that right. All right. We'll step aside. We're back with more just ahead here on Connections.
MSO News Sports is a unique multimedia website providing exclusive news and sports content for the North Shore. Our goal is to keep you connected to your local neighbors throughout Essex County and beyond. We feature the best of the North Shore, and we couldn't provide this service without the powerful support of our local sponsors, like Sylvan Street Grill, in Peabody and Salisbury, the Bradford Tavern in Rowley. Just like us, they care about the North Shore. Check out all of our podcasts and share our website with your friends. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. msonewsports@gmail.com. Again, we are your connection to the best of the North Shore. msonewsports.com.
Essex County Sheriff Kevin Coppinger is joining us on the line. And Kevin, welcome. Good to be talking with you.
Same here, Bill. Thank you for the invite.
Kevin, we've talked a number of times over the last few years. Every time I talk to you, I think, man, you have a tough job. But it just went times 10, I think, in the last several weeks, hasn't it?
No, you're so right. This is a whole new experience. A couple weeks ago, I said I've never seen anything like this since the morning of 9/11, and we have far surpassed that just with trying to get a handle on this and make sure we take care of, for us here at the jail, the safety as well as the health of not only our inmate staff, but also, our inmate population, but also our staff. It's a very difficult task, and it's a 24/7 operation as we speak. It's just really to a new level, unimaginable.
Exactly. And Kevin, what you would have to do here is you have the services that you deliver require that you can't change too much. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we have to come up with that delicate balance, as I said, of safety for all and providing the services that are needed for the inmate population, and taking preventive measures that society in general are now doing. I mean, we've all, know what the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is. I think most people are familiar with that. Department of Public Health, we're listening to the governor on a daily basis, the president on a daily basis. There's more experts out there that are sending information on, good personal hygiene techniques, stay-at-home advisories. What I'd just like to say, good common sense. It's like, folks, pay attention to what the experts in their fields of knowledge are saying, because this is real. This isn't a movie. This isn't a fantasy. This is reality. It's spreading right now like wildfire. And as we all know, the next 10 days to 2 weeks, we're supposed to peak, and these numbers are just going off the scale in terms of confirmed cases and, horribly so, fatalities. And if we don't all pitch in and do the right thing here, we could lose control of this.
Kevin, Sheriff Coppinger, is there any specific information specific either to your facilities or other state county facilities that you can share with us?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I'm going to speak specific for Essex because obviously that's my focus. But I can honestly say that every day we have conference calls with all my fellow sheriffs here in Massachusetts, and we're all doing the same thing in each of our locations. But here in Essex, we've been working on this since February when we first started hearing hints that this was coming, trying to follow the trends, worldwide trends, and hearing it come this way. So I'm glad we took the incentive then to get prepared. But just to summarize it, because I can speak for like 3 hours, Bill, and you and I will be here longer than we should. But I'd like to highlight a couple of things that we have done. First and foremost, we have pretty much really restricted access to 2 hour facilities from everyone except our staff and our main vendors. When I say main vendors, I'm talking about our healthcare partners. As you might recall, we privatized our healthcare services to a company called WellPath, and they came in with doctors and nurses and physician's assistants, and they do a tremendous job for us, taking care of the public, the healthcare of our inmates. We also have a food vendor, Aramark, to make sure the inmates get fed three squares a day. We have another vendor called Spectrum, who's providing mental health services, and then we have what you and I have talked about before, the medication-assisted treatment vendor, Acadia, who's keeping that program up with us. But really quickly, a couple things we're doing. We have stopped general visitation, so the general public cannot come into the facility. It is very unfortunate that we do not allow them to see, to visit with the inmates, but it is just an absolute necessity when you talk about social distancing and bringing the virus inside. To offset that, because we really truly do recognize the importance of having loved ones and family members, meet, see the inmate on a routine basis. We've tried to compensate that by allowing our inmates, number one, more access to telephones, and number two, we are giving the inmates two free 30-minute phone calls each week so they can make those extra calls free of charge to stay in touch. Since now well over a month, I can probably go back like 6 weeks now, we're in a very robust cleaning protocols here at the jail. We're in touch with our epidemiologist, infectious disease control experts, and how to clean the facility. We have clean crews going round the clock, all public areas, all surfaces. We understand this virus is spread through droplets. So anywhere droplets, when you speak, obviously, droplets come out of your mouth and then they hit surfaces like countertops, desks, common areas, doorknobs, handrails. This stuff's all getting, scrubbed down, several times a day, like I said, 24/7. Attorneys still have right of access to come in and talk to their clients, but we're doing those what we call a non-contact visit. So there is, there is plexiglass between them and their inmates so they can't, expose either side, one or the other. We have a very robust education program going through the jail, both for our staff and the inmates, on good personal hygiene, washing hands, as recommended by the CDC and DPH, 20 minutes. We make sure we have extra hand sanitizing stations throughout the facility. We've given the inmates extra bars of soap so they can obviously wash as much as they can. In terms of personal protective equipment, which, pick up any newspaper today, I know the healthcare, the hospitals and the healthcare workers are having trouble getting this. We are too, and we need it. So that's where I go back to some of the preventive aspects we started back in February. We ordered a lot of this stuff that we could. Now, I'm not overwhelmed with it by any means, but we have issued the N95 masks to our staff. Our healthcare provider has it for their own staff anyway. They provide their own equipment to their staff, so they have this. But we have the N95s issued to our offices, particularly when they're guarding an inmate who may be suspected with this or any other infectious disease or any other germ-producing environment where they can wear that if they're in close proximity within 6 feet of that individual. We have, starting last Saturday, and I believe we were the first sheriff's department in the Commonwealth to do it, we've issued all our staff a mandated order that they will wear a surgical mask. And that's from me all the way down to the junior officer. We wear those anytime we're on the property. If you look at it, what could happen here is the inmates are here, and they're pretty much secured. I mean, from the public, it's the staff we could have concerns who may bring this virus inside. So we're taking every precaution we can. So by giving staff members the masks, it does reduce the possibility of us bringing it in there. And we have screening procedures in place. So when the staff comes to work every day, and when I say staff, it's also those vendors I mentioned, we're going through the routine questions. How do you feel? Do you have a cough? Do you have a respiratory illness? Do you have a fever? And then if they say yes, then we just take it to the next step. And if there's any particular concerns, we advise them not to come into the facilities and to contact their primary care physician. This is at all three of our main facilities here at Middleton, obviously a main campus, up at the pre-release center in Lawrence, and at the Women in Transition Center up in Salisbury. In terms of the courts, everybody knows a lot of the courts are closed, and they have been now. I think we might be entering week three or four. I think it might be four, actually. So we have a very intensive video conferencing system here that we work with all the district courts in the county. So we're doing arraignments here and any type of special hearings that are requested by the anyone involved with the court system, so we can have the inmate participate in those through video conferencing. And that's a short version of, like I said, a very long. There's a lot of other programs here. I mean, other issues here that we have, trying to adjust. One thing I would like to note, though, that I mean, we have stopped volunteers coming in, and some of the other providers that aren't that essential. But those, like, for instance, those ones that help us with prevention education for, like, anti-violence programs, as well as our partners from Northern Essex Community College who teach the inmate different subjects on an educational role. Even though they're not on site, those vendors do provide us with individual learning packets that we give to the inmates so they can work on their education on their own time, you know, and just moving stuff back and forth. Almost like a lot of the schools are doing here. We don't do it by video because obviously videos are not in the cells, but we have the work packets that are based on educational curriculum. So we give those to the inmates and they work on those and they can share those back and forth eventually with the instructors from the college.
Kevin, man, you've given us a lot of information. I'll just follow up with a couple of quick follow-ups, and that would be, I would imagine, what's the procedure for a new inmate coming in?
That is a great question. I'm glad you said that because I almost forgot that one. It's one of the most important things we're doing. We have created what we call a new man unit. Now, the medical experts in the fields tell us that, well, you see it or hear it all the time. If somebody is suspected or not feeling well, they tell them to self-quarantine for 14 days because that's the period we're being told if you're going to have, if you do have coronavirus, then those symptoms will present themselves. So anybody new coming into the jail or anybody returning to the jail, a quick example is if we have to take an inmate to a hospital for a routine or you know, God forbid, an emergency or some kind of health care issue, if they come back, they go into the new man unit where they are isolated in a separate housing unit, and they remain there for 14 days under the observation of medical staff. So if they become symptomatic and they show any of those classic signs I mentioned before, the fever, the cough, the respiratory illness, then the medical staff will do their routine and work with them, and hopefully they don't have it. And once they get by the 14-day quarantine, then they will be, if there's no symptoms, they will be moved into the general population and out to another area. So in effect, we've created our own 14-day quarantine for anybody new as an extra precaution, so we're not bringing the disease into the institutions.
You know, last point would be is that I'm watching all the stuff that you're watching, and you're way ahead of it than I am, I think. But it's interesting that you mentioned the staff wearing masks, and that's absolutely right, because it's the people that might have it are the ones that should be wearing the masks. And you're right, those would be the guys that or the women that would be bringing it in potentially. So that just makes a lot of sense, and I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, and again, we're correctional experts. We're not medical experts. So we're tapping every resource we can find.
Well, you're becoming medical experts, I think.
Believe me, you asked me 6 weeks ago if I knew all the stuff I know today. I would have thought you were crazy. But I do want to make one important point, though, on the issue of the masks, too. If an inmate asks for a mask, we will provide them with them upon request. Right now, I don't have enough to go all around, but we do have a lot of orders that have been placed, and stock is coming in every day. And very shortly, I do anticipate I will be able to give each of the inmates a mask, and then that will be another mandatory wear situation for them too, because you know we don't want this virus inside, and if it does get inside, we need to control it as best possible. So right now, as we just discussed, Bill, you know, we're limiting the sources of bringing it in, i.e., our staff. But if it gets in, we don't want the inmates spreading it either. So we will. If an inmate asks today for a mask, we will certainly give it to them. And as soon as I get enough stock in here, we will provide each inmate with a mask and make it mandatory wear, too. Just another level of caution.
And my last thing, Sheriff, would be I really applaud you on the extra phone calls, because I was thinking about that. The fact that you're an inmate and then you can't have visitors, and you got to do something to compensate, and that sounds like just the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I'll tell you just another thing that we learned, and actually I learned this in my old career when I was a police officer. If you communicate with people any changes that you're going to make, and you're upfront with them and you explain the reasons to them why you're doing it, you know, you get compliance. So we have gone really above and beyond. So when we first put these changes in, like when we stopped the visitation, I asked the superintendents to go out and meet with the different housing units, with the inmates in the different housing units, and just explain to them why we're doing this. And it was really for their own personal welfare. And the inmates, the response was very positive. They understood. When we showed up with the masks wearing them last Saturday, we actually got, I won't say applause, but we got accolades from the inmates saying, thank you. Hey, you know, you're worried about our health. But the other day, Monday, I think it was Monday this week, yeah, we did a little quick video that I just kind of went on for the inmates. It's being shown in all the housing units, just, again, thanking them for helping us out. Explaining what we're doing, some of the procedures. We have it in English and Spanish, And then we have a couple of videos that are playing in there, too, that we got from the Department of Public Health on good personal hygiene. And you know, we have a little small package that we're going to be distributing on Saturday to our partner at Aramark. It's not much. It's just a little extra thing for the inmates where it's some extra writing paper and a stamped envelope. So on us, just another little avenue for the inmates so they can write a letter home or to their loved one if they want. But I got to say, for the inmates, they're well educated. We're keeping them up to speed. They understand it. It does get frustrating because we do have to restrict some of their daily routines, like social distancing. We got to make sure they stay 6 feet apart, like you and your shop and everybody outside the jails. But as long as we explain it to them and they ask questions, we give them honest answers. So far, it's been pretty good. I have to applaud the inmates for their cooperation.
Well, good luck, and for all that you guys, your staff is doing there. A very difficult job, again, just getting more difficult by the day, I guess. But, Sheriff, always good talking with you, and best of luck.
Thank you, Bill, and same to you. Good health.
Yep, you too. Stay safe. Sheriff Kevin Coppinger with us from the Essex County Sheriff's Office. Just ahead on Connections, Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll joins us. Then Eric Smith, Fire Chief in Gloucester. And then to get you ready for the weekend, Tim Kearns is here with some beer news.
Harrington Trophy has been rewarding the North Shore for over 30 years with quality custom awards, screen printing, embroidery, and more. We pride our family-owned business on our exceptional customer service and quality products for the right price. Custom t-shirts, sweatshirts, warm-up suits, hats, along with the area's top trophies, plaques, glass awards, we are the one-stop shop for end-of-the-year banquets or advertising your small business through apparel. Come see us at Harrington Trophy, Chestnut Street, Lynn, or harringtontrophy.com.
Enjoy the taste of summer all year round at Cherry Farm Creamery. Pick up an ice cream cake for that special occasion. Cherry Farm Creamery offers the best ice cream right off Route 128 on Conant Street in Danvers. Or visit them at cherryfarmcreamery.com.
All right, this is take two with Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll, and I apologize for that, having screwed up the first one. But, Madam Mayor, let's just get right to the chase. Superintendent search is in its stretch run now.
Yeah, we're excited about the candidates that we have that are interested in this position. We've got four finalists after a screening committee spent some time interviewing just about nine candidates and narrowed it down to four. So the next role is for the school committee to interview folks and hopefully come to a decision at the end of this week.
In my experience as an educator, we had a lot of superintendents come in from the outside, and they actually stated and were hired, well, this is my last job, I've come here to retire. I don't get that feeling from Salem, so maybe a quick thumbnail of your finalists?
Sure. You know, I just would start out to say our community profile that we spent some time kind of understanding what are the key skill sets we think in the next superintendent talked about one being a strong communicator really being important. And I think another component was really wanting somebody who would stay, who would grow the people who were here, bringing some sustainability to our efforts. We've had a lot of transitions, a lot of staff turnover, and it never is really helpful when you're constantly, you know, bringing in new leadership. So we're excited about this, not necessarily being someone who's going to retire here, but certainly somebody who wants to build a model so that when they leave, things don't fall apart, right? We want someone who brings out those foundational skills. So we've got four candidates. Dr. Lorenzo Garcia currently works in the Revere Public School System. He was the high school principal who was responsible for their successful turnaround there. Revere is known as one of the best urban high schools in the country. Mm-hmm. He's now working in central office, doing a lot of data and accountability work, and brought, I think, local experience and Gateway City experience. Ben Lummis. Ben is the current interim superintendent in Brookline. He's been part of their senior leadership team for the last 5 to 7 years. He was also a teacher, an educational consultant. He's got a really varied background. Dr. Steven Shrike. He is the current superintendent/receiver in Holyoke for Holyoke Public Schools. He was brought in 5 years ago to help address some of the needs of their school system. DESE actually appointed a receiver, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Ed, because they were concerned about their performance in Holyoke. Mm-hmm. And by all accounts, he's helped transition the school district to one that is much higher functioning, increased graduation rates, built a strong early ed program, increased base, their dual language program, definitely brings a strong base of experience to a city like ours. And finally, Erin McMahon. Erin has a varied background. She's worked in Denver Public Schools. She's been a network superintendent there. Has worked in New York City. Certainly been a teacher as well. All of these folks have been teachers in their careers at one point or another. She's currently working for KIPP, a charter school network at the national level, doing their academic achievement efforts. And they were all, like I said, pretty impressive group. The pool was pretty impressive. So narrowing it down to four folks who want to be here, are excited about the opportunity to help us, is pretty exciting.
It sounds exciting. It sounds like tremendous, tremendously qualified candidates. Let's shift gears a little bit now and talk a little bit about where the city budget is, and maybe referencing the schools, because there's supposed to be money coming down from the state to in a different way.
Yeah, we're just getting started. Department heads are getting started preparing their budgets. We'll spend the next 2 months, 6 to 8 weeks, really honing in on what the needs are, where we think we want to make any additional investments to better serve the needs of the community. The process for us is very much dependent upon what we're going to be seeing in state resources, which at present, we're a little concerned. The new ed dollars, the school sweepstakes funding that's helped a lot of Gateway cities so far for us is looking like a very small increase. Right now we're at $136,000, which isn't going to buy us a lot of even pay for some of the existing expenses, let alone some of the newer things we're hoping to invest in. So we're going to work through that. We've got two more shots and bites at the apple with the budget through the House and the Senate. We're working with our legislative leaders to hopefully increase that sum.
Okay. I've asked you this before, and it's a continuing question about public housing and about affordable housing in the city as cities and towns continue to transition, struggle with infrastructure and everything else. So what's the status of that?
Yeah, it's the number one issue we're really facing as a community is the affordability of housing. As Greater Boston's just become such a desirable place to live, we've seen the rents in Salem increase dramatically, housing prices as well. But rents are the things that impact people who live here, who work in our service industry, or those who want to stay here, who've been here a long time, haven't bought, and now are seeing rents rising much quicker than their incomes are rising. We've been looking at a number of policies. Last year, we attempted to pass an accessory dwelling unit, or an ADU, essentially allowing in-laws to be created in homes. It wasn't successful. We're hoping to resubmit that, along with an inclusionary housing ordinance, trying to find some policy considerations that will help build affordable housing as housing growth in Salem happens. In addition, we're looking to leverage public land. So where we have public assets, to think about lowering the cost of constructing housing by making the cost of land acquisition much more affordable. It is by far one of the toughest challenges that communities are facing, especially for a place like Salem that has long had a mix of different people, different income levels, different cultures. When you become a high-priced area, that changes. And we don't want to change the character of Salem. We like the fact that we've got a hip, historic mix of people who live here. But that's in danger if we don't really address this housing issue head on.
And do the what's the relationship? I think I've asked you this before, but the relationship between Salem city government and the state government in terms of the local representatives, the local state representative, the local state senator?
Oh, I think we've got excellent representation in Paul Tucker and Joan Lovely, both of whom were either local officials or elected officials or appointed official, former police chief, Joan, a former city councilor. And they've been fabulous to work with. I think they really recognize the importance of this issue in Salem. Joan represents other communities on the North Shore as well. Diagnosing the problem isn't the hard part. It's curing the illness that is really, really tricky, because there's only so much you can do as a government entity, right? We need private sector and public sector to come together and help build the sort of housing we need in our community at a time when people, don't always want additional housing happening. You understand some of those fears and trepidation, but we also know that if we don't build new housing, we're never going to get out of this affordable housing crunch that we're in.
Well, I want to pull back a little bit now and look at a larger geographic area, if I can. There are two things that are on my mind, and I guess we'll start with the local then and go from there. You were at an event featuring Joe Kennedy for the Senate. Would you like to tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. I've been at several events. He's been in Salem a number of times. He was in PBD last month, and over the weekend he was in Middleton. He's been, you know, running around the Commonwealth trying to talk about why he's interested in being United States Senator, what skills he'll bring to it. I think he's a terrific candidate who recognizes the needs at the local level. He's not somebody who just swoops into town and wants to talk politics. He's really here to understand particularly our most vulnerable, you know, community members, like what are the needs? We've been in our health center. We've been in at LifeBridge. We talk about education and early ed. We real, you know, sort of changes that are necessary to meet the demands of a diverse city. And at the same time, I think he brings the heft of understanding like systemic changes that are necessary in Washington. So I'm hopeful.
One thing I noticed with Senator Kennedy, Senator Edward Kennedy, over the years, whether you like him or don't like him, whatever his history was and so on, is that whenever he came to Gloucester in particular is where I would see him, he remembered people by their first names. And as you said, he was aware of the local issues. I haven't seen that with our current senators. I was going to say as much, but I really haven't seen it as all. And it sounds to me like you have that little bit of a connection anywhere with this candidate.
I think it's very true, and that's probably a good analogy. I mean, not just because he's a family member, but the ability to understand what's happening locally and then to connect that to what we need to do in Washington to help. That skill doesn't exist everywhere, and I want more. Like, I want more out of a United States Senator. We are not going to be the strongest city we can be, the smartest city we can be, the safest city we can be without having a strong federal partner and having people who recognize that, want to know the issues, and then know how to make that systemic change and influence others to do so as well.
Well, that would require some working together, but we'll leave that for another day. Now, obviously, Tuesday, we're recording this on Monday, and, you know, Tuesday is the New Hampshire primary. After maybe your comments on the debacle, first of all, from Iowa.
Holy cocoa, right? Unbelievable. And, you know, it makes Democrats look like the gang that can't shoot straight. You know, that's definitely what you don't want to have happening. I don't know, obviously, all the details of what happened in Iowa. But it does really make you question, is this, you know, the kind of the best approach to selecting a candidate when things like that happen? I do appreciate the difference between New Hampshire, where you actually have – it's a primary, right? Just the way it would be in Massachusetts and a number of other states. It's not run by a party. It's run by local elected officials. And at least that's a normal – there are regs, there are rules, there are laws, and it's a normal way of doing business. And hopefully, you know, something like that can be considered down the line in Iowa and other places.
For, I was going to say Gloucester, but for Massachusetts public officials who lean toward the Democrats or are Democrats, what is the view? What do you look at from the New Hampshire primary in terms of either outcome or who's saying what?
Yeah, I think it's such a strange year. It's hard to know what the impacts are going to be. Who would have thought what happened in Iowa would have happened, right? Normally somebody gets a bump out of that. It's momentum to go to the next place. Or you win Iowa and you end up, you know, somehow on the cutting room floor in New Hampshire, right? And so I think it's one of those years where we're seeing, you know, three or four candidates that are viable, you know, in the mix and seem to have good organizations, well-funded. And then you've got candidates who've skipped Iowa and New Hampshire pretty much altogether, but have resources or name recognition and are still on the hunt. So it's a really interesting and unique year.
Finally, Madam Mayor, I don't quite know how to phrase the question, but on a local level, on a personal level, people sometimes will not talk about national politics because, if I'm on the left, I have a friend on the right, we sort of don't want to end up slapping each other. How does that work with public officials when you get together for these meetings? Is it sort of hands-off for national politics?
I mean, when we're in a government setting, we're probably talking about whatever the issue is beforehand. Right. But if there's socializing or kibitzing going on, I think there's a lot of real conversations and some good-natured jabbing and opportunities to recognize that no one candidate, no one party has all the answers, right? And there are things that you're able to talk about with candor when you're talking to colleagues that I think we all respect each other for the ability to do that.
Well, may that catch on and go somewhere else.
Right? It's at the heart of the problem.
Exactly. Thank you, Madam Mayor. That's Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore.
This season, start with a winning mortgage rate from your hometown team. Whether you are thinking about buying a new home or condo or refinancing your existing one, our loan rates are among the lowest anywhere. Check out our full menu of rates and terms and apply online 24/7 at institutionforsavingsloans.com. Institutionforsavings.com, member FDIC, DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. Professional builders and remodelers choose Anderson Windows more than any other brand in the United States. They do so because Anderson Windows and patio doors offer beautiful natural wood interiors, low-maintenance exteriors, and outstanding energy efficiency. See the complete line of Anderson Windows at any of our three locations in Beverly, North Reading, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
All right, we're back now with old friend Gloucester Fire Chief Eric Smith. And, Chief, so glad to be talking with you. Wish it were better circumstances. How are you?
I'm good. I would definitely prefer it to be better circumstances, and face-to-face would be great. But as we know, the social distancing rules have changed things up a little bit, so we'll do it the technology way.
Well, tonight we're going to talk basically about the firehouse situation, if I may, and then hopefully at some point I'll talk with the assistant chief, who is the crisis management director in Gloucester. That can be at a later date. But Chief, in terms of staffing, has anything changed with respect to this emergency?
It has, and like any kind of large scale. Fortunately at this moment in time, we're not being overrun with EMS calls, which is, thank God. We do expect that to pick up, and that the severity of cases and the acuity of patients will probably increase, and it's going to, take more time. The calls themselves take more time because of, when you're dealing with folks who have a communicable disease, and as virulent as this one appears to be, with on its face, without a lot of scientific evidence, out of an abundance of caution, everybody's got to wear the proper PPE with personal protective equipment. So we have added one additional rescue. We do own four machines in the city, so we've always have two stood up out of the main station. We do own two backups because inevitably in the mechanical world something is broken, and on occasion two things are broken, and during the summer months when things are normal, we have a lot of events in town, and we stand up a third squad that these events pay for the staffing to come out when it's appropriate and necessary. So we've stood that third truck up already and positioned it out in West Gloucester. We're positioned to stand up another truck and put that out in Bayview, as well as enhance the staffing on the engines and the ladder truck to some degree, because this it gets to be a little bit manpower intensive, and we're looking to have at least 4 to 5 people showing up on each of these calls as much as we can to ensure that we have somebody that's doing all the right things, an incident commander who's also the safety officer, so everybody's getting an eye on them to make sure that their PP is on and it is on correctly, and that when we're coming out of the house, if we don't transport, or when we're leaving the hospital, that everybody is doing all the right things to contain any contamination that we've encountered, and that we're protecting our employees and making sure that we're not only wearing the right equipment, but taking it off the right way, and then, decontaminating our vehicles, as well as all the personnel that were on the call, get out of those clothes, launder those clothes, have a shower. These are typical things that the fire service does, after every fire call, because of the contamination that you run into and smoke and toxins in that environment. So this is much like that, or any kind of, hazardous materials call where you're wearing specialized equipment to protect you from the hazard. And then when you take it off out of an abundance of caution, you go the extra mile and wash the clothes, wash yourself, and get everything all cleaned up and back in service. So it is taking more time. If the intensity and tempo of the calls pick up, then that will become, a challenge for us to try to go through every single phase and step that we put in place now to protect the employees. And so there may be those instances where we're doing a quick decon at the hospital and getting out of the gear that was contaminated and into a new set and responding immediately from there. And the truck is going to have to get a quick decon. So to be able to turn a vehicle around after we put a patient in there, because the next call might not be for a patient with COVID, and the last call may not have been a confirmed COVID patient. So, you know, we're working with a lack of information and a communicable disease. So, you know, our posture is that every patient may have COVID, act accordingly. And you know, in between every call, we're always deconning our vehicles. It's just the nature of the business and standard practice. And in these cases, with it maybe something with patients that are coughing and aerosolization, it's an even more intensive cleaning process. Takes more people to get it done, especially if you're trying to do it quickly and get to the next patient to make sure that the environment that we're putting that next patient in is appropriate, mm-hmm. and that it's clean, and that there isn't a risk that we could cross-contaminate them. So, there's a lot of things that are a bit different, but very similar to what we do every day. It's just obviously a higher risk for our personnel, as everybody's seen in the news and the media, how this thing works and the risk that it poses for healthcare workers and, you know, EMTs and paramedics and firefighters and police out on the front line of this thing or right in the line of fire, literally. So it's a lot of the same, but much more intense and yet another risk elevation that we have to assess and manage.
Do you estimate that you have the gear that you need?
We do. I mean, there's certainly, you know, the unknown as to how many patients are we going to get and how much are we going to burn through. Right now, I totally understand why our numbers are where they're at. Call volume is, if anything, slightly lower than what is normal, because folks that would normally call us looking for assistance and you know, for us to take care of lesser acute issues and get them to the hospital are opting to, you know, use telehealth and telemedicine and, you know, get in contact with their primary care physicians and really trying to abide by the guidance out there in a medical community that is, listen, if we can take care of you over the phone and keep you home and safe and distanced from others and not bring you into the hospital, that's better in many ways. We don't risk you getting exposed to something in a cross contamination or environmental situation, but we also are leaving those hotbed and staff available for what we know is probably coming, what we're seeing happening in New York and other areas that are, you know, what they say are, you know, they're a week in front of us or 5 days, 10 days in front of us on dealing with this, that they, you know, it got to them first and they're already ramped up and, you know, that we're kind of next in line as this thing moves around. So, you know, we're in that position now where we are not at our peak. We don't know exactly when that peak will be. We don't know to what degree it's going to affect us, as in the total volume of patients and calls to address. So, we're optimistic and hopeful that we're as prepared as we can be, and we'll know when the time comes if we are as prepared as we think we are.
A couple of more questions, Chief. Communications with you and the state, or with you and other firehouses around the North Shore, is that an ongoing thing?
We're involved in a lot of statewide conference calls, both Assistant Chief Aiello and I, and many others within the city, based on their specialization and what they do. You know, from our financial folks to our business community representatives and liaisons. So there's a lot of pieces to this that everyone's seeing, with unemployment benefits and SBA loans, and so there's a lot of compartmentalization and specialization into those areas and those, folks within our administration and staff and the mayor's office and in the, communications that she's having up at the higher levels that trickle down and then spread out to us at our level. So we have routine, meetings with emergency management at the state level that are specific to police, fire, EMS, because of obviously the things that are most important to us are going to be different than the things that are most important to, you know, community development and planning, and the things they're trying to help the business community through, and as well as schools and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on all at once. I think, you know, city staff, the mayor's office, certainly, you know, my opinion of where the fire department, the police department are at, everybody seems to be right on point and doing their jobs extremely well under fairly difficult circumstances, and with offices being in large part closed and with staffing reduced to the bare minimum, and, you know, in an effort to do the same thing that we're telling everybody else to do. I mean, we have to try to maintain that social distancing as well and stop the spread of this thing so we can get it under control and stamp it out.
Talking with the chief of the Gloucester Fire Department, Eric Smith. And finally, Chief, in terms of the firehouses themselves, where your men are quartered from time to time, they're in close quarters. What has changed in each of the facilities in terms of protecting the men and how they relate to one another?
Yep, so that is definitely a challenge. You've been in all of our firehouses, I think, and certainly the, you know, the outskirts stations, as we call them, in the West Gloucester, Bayview, Magnolia, you know, their staffing levels aren't as high as downtown. They're running typically one engine out of those stations, although we are running an engine and a rescue out of West Gloucester right now, so that staffing complement has gone up. But those stations are designed to house anywhere from, you know, 4 to 6 people, and we can do that and meet those, you know, social distancing needs with the space that's in the building. Obviously, once you get in a truck, you're probably closer than 6 feet away from each other face to face, and that's why we are so stringent on what we're doing in the firehouse. You know, every station and every firefighter is supposed to be monitoring their temperatures when they're off duty and their health when they're off duty. We have pounded the message into everyone on the city staff, and especially those that have this elevated risk here in the firehouse, just because of proximity in the building and direct exposure to patients that are really sick with this thing. It's critically important that we monitor everyone's health closely, and if anybody's starting to show any signs or symptoms, that they're out of the game. They need to stay home, get the appropriate health care, and so we, you know, we're taking it very seriously. Temperatures at home, making sure that if you're getting elevated, you got to call in and put yourself out sick. If it shows that it looks like it might be a COVID case, not you know, just a, you know, my allergies are up or I got a cold, then that is handled a little differently on what we're doing, because we know our folks have an exposure potential here at work, and that if they're getting sick, it very well likely be made, you know, something in the exposure here, and we just don't know enough about the virus with this 2 to 14 days you know, of incubation time before you show signs and symptoms. It's possible to get somebody in the station working together that may have it and doesn't know it yet, and can potentially spread that to others. So we're doing everything we can that's humanly possible. We're checking temperatures when people come into work before they even really get in the building. When they come in the front door, they got to check their temperature and make sure that they're reporting that to their officers that, yep, I don't have a temp and I don't have any signs or symptoms of COVID, I'm good to go. And we're checking those routinely throughout the day to make sure that nothing's changed, because this thing can start to develop on you mid-shift. And if it does, you got to go home, and then we need to take the appropriate steps to look after anybody else that you might have been around and determine if they should go home as well, as a potential additional exposure. Set up testing, you know, get you home, get you quarantined, the daily monitoring. So this is a whole different level that we've never, ever really dealt with in our circumstance, and it's every day. I mean, this is the new normal that we're operating under. So it's definitely a challenge. It's putting a lot more stress on folks than we would like to see. So we're, you know, looking at ways to try to keep their minds occupied doing other things. But unfortunately, there's, you know, lots of policy procedure. It's all new. There isn't a whole lot that's been written specific to this issue, but, you know, we're applying a lot of the techniques and training and ways that we handle isolation and mitigation and separation of people from hazards in this instance as well. And I think it's going pretty well, and I've got a lot of smart people that have really helped a lot in getting our policy procedures crafted, and we'll, you know, as we get through this thing, we'll have a lot of lessons learned, and we'll fix whatever mistakes we've been making, and we'll capitalize on the things that we did well and share it with others, so we're you know, better prepared if and when this thing resurges or comes back. We just don't know, so it's kind of a new normal.
Lord knows we need you guys, Chief. Is there anything else that I didn't ask about that maybe you might want to mention?
No, I think we're in pretty good shape. You know, we've had some smart people and a lot of great employees here that have put forward a lot of these issues way back with H1N1. So we're not in the best of shape, I would say, with you know, N95s, you know, the masks that we wear as healthcare providers and surgical masks and gloves. But we are not in horrible shape. There are certainly people out there that are not nearly as fortunate. And I guess really the word is prepared, and prepared in advance, and have the stock on hand as we have been. And so, you know, our department is kind of leading the charge on providing all the PPE throughout the city for all the healthcare workers that work for the city, the police department, you know, over Board of Health, as well as a lot of the social service agencies that are really on the front line as well, Meals on Wheels folks. And, you know, people at Open Door that are serving food and getting people groceries, these people are incredible, and I can't thank them enough, because what they're doing and how they're helping people socially distance is a direct impact on the services that are demanded out of this fire department if we can slow the spread. And I think what they're doing is stellar work, and I can't thank them enough, and we're right in there with them. We have a meeting with them twice a week with everybody on a big conference call. You know, our incident commander on this is Karen Carroll, and the staff over at the Board of Health. And we're, you know, even though we're kind of on the front lines of dealing with the patients, they are definitely the lead element, because this is a Board of Health issue. This is a public health issue. And a lot of this falls right into their wheelhouse, and she and her staff are doing great work with the nurses and folks that they have working over there to track the people that have cases and keep everybody on the right page and the messaging behind the health aspect of this and the command and control. They're doing a great job. So we're glad to be here to help support that and to deal with folks as they get sick. And, you know, and we're doing our part to help with the PPE and hand sanitizer and mask, gloves, and all that to everybody that we can get them to that has a need. So we've done pretty well in prioritizing that. And I don't think anybody that's had a need has gone unfilled, which is actually incredible when you look at some of the stories across the country and even as close as in Boston with some of the hospitals and what they're going through. You know, it's tough times for a lot of folks out there, and we are very, very fortunate with where we're positioned.
All right, that is Gloucester Fire Chief Eric Smith. All right, back with the beer pod now, and Coach Tim Kearns. Coach, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm good, Rick. Very good.
It's very hard right now with the beer pod, because the intention of this, in honor of the late Liam Flanagan, the beer snob, was to go out and visit some of these microbreweries in the area to learn more about the local beers, and to teach me about all this stuff, how to taste them. And you talk, and we can review a little bit how to taste and the shape of the glasses and stuff like that. But it's a little disappointing, Tim, that we actually can't get out right now. And I know that you're familiar with some of the breweries in the area.
Yeah, you know, a number of the places, as we discussed last time, are offering online purchasing. You can call ahead and order your beer, and then you can drive up and let them know you're out there. And using your charge card, you can pay for the beers, and they'll bring them out for you. So it's one way to support your local brewers and to just keep really good fresh beer at home.
All right, now, you know, Tim, a question I haven't asked before, and people ask me about it, because I am a Guinness snob, Guinness. However, people ask me, well, when you were in Ireland, you know, do they serve the beer warm? And the answer was no, they did not serve Guinness warm. It was served chilled, just as it is here, you know, on tap and so on. And are there still beers around? I remember when we lived in Germany, my dad was in the service back in the early 60s, and we lived over there, and he used to get, I think it was Löwenbräu with the bottles, you know, that have the metal caps where you put the cap back on and so
yep.
on.
Yep.
He got those, and those were warm, and they were supposed to be drunk, I think, warm. So is there such a thing as warm beer?
Yeah, I actually will let my beers warm up before I drink them. I don't like them ice cold any longer. Certain American pilsners, you'll want ice cold, like a Coors Light. A Coors Light is best when it's really, really cold. It's very, very refreshing on those hot summer days. But a good quality beer, if you get it too cold, to me, it sort of kills the flavor of the beer. If you let it get to a cooler temperature, it allows the aromas to really present themselves. It allows the taste to really differentiate themselves when they get to your palate. I enjoyed a Dogfish Head Worldwide Stout, which is 12 or 10%. I have to check here.
Well, you're talking double digits, so it's powerful.
We're talking double digits for the Worldwide Stout, and it's a great stout, and it's one that I have aged down in my cellar, which is cool, for at least the last 3 to 4 years. And I'll tell you, it was very, very, very smooth. A lot of times, if you drank a 120 fairly new, it has a real punch to it. But as it ages, some of the hoppiness flares out, and you can really enjoy the smoothness of the beer itself.
So I don't know anybody with a wine cellar, but now I know someone with a beer cellar.
Yeah. Liam and I sort of put one together, he along with his brother Tom, down in Liam's cellar. We must have had probably 75 to 80 bottles aging down in the cellar of all different types. And when we'd have our beer get-togethers, we'd always break out 3 or 4 of them and try them. And they were aged anywhere from 1 to 5 or more years. And it really changes the flavor and the mouthfeel of the beer. Again, this Dogfish was downstairs in my cellar for a good 3 to 4 years. I have another one that I've had down there for at least the same amount of time. It is from Avery Brewery, and it is their Pumpkins, and that is a 17.2% alcohol.
Oh, my God. I've never heard of that before.
I've got to break this one up. Now, that will be much the same. It's an imperial, and so it is going to have it would have been a heavier beer, higher alcohol content, and it's going to have smoothed out quite a bit. It's still going to have the alcohol kick, but the flavor itself is going to be much smoother.
Well, you're not.
I'm really looking forward to trying that one.
You wouldn't need any anesthesia, man, if you're going for an operation. Holy Toledo.
No, you wouldn't. And that's a very high alcohol content.
Lordy.
Here, you know?
So, and something that powerful in alcohol, is there an actual beer taste flavor?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, but you're going to get, it's a much heavier beer taste. Like the Dogfish Head is a dark beer with a big amount of barley, as they advertise it. But at this point in the aging, it's really smoothed out, so you're not getting a lot of that crispness of the barley. You're just getting this nice, smooth, malty taste throughout the mouthfeel. It was very good. Because you don't drink it a lot. This is one that you sit and you sip for. Let's see. It took me over an hour to enjoy it. So soft beers, they're not beers that you're going to rush through. You're going to sit back and you're going to sit them almost like a fine wine or an aperitif, a port. You don't guzzle those. You sip them. You enjoy the mouthfeel. You enjoy the aroma. You enjoy the overall flavor.
Yeah,
and that's the way that, you know, Liam and I used to enjoy them as we sat in this front room in the leather chairs. And we'd just sit back in the chit-chat and in the conversation. You would just keep enjoying sips of the beer, and whenever they were empty, we'd go back and we'd crack another one of some vintage.
That reminds me of some of the movies you see with the guy in a smoking jacket, and they repair to the, you know, to the room for a brandy and so on, and they just have conversation. And you know, that's an important distinction, Tim. We make fun, but this is not an alcoholic binge type thing. This is tasting, and it's tasteful, and it's fascinating to me to learn about this stuff because you know, I'm the old Budweiser type where you pop a Bud bottle and that's it, and you swill it down, you know, after a hard day out in the sun. But this is different, and we're talking primarily craft beers. And in that vein, Tim, how long can you store these in your house or in your cellar, whether they be in cans or bottles or growlers for that? You told us about growlers last time. But what about
growlers,
cans or bottles?
Growlers you want to drink right away.
Right.
Generally, growlers are they're from your local brewery. They're very, very fresh. And you want to drink those generally within 4 or 5 days. And that's when the flavor is really... really popping in the beer, especially your lighter beers, your wheat beers, your pilsner or anything like that. Your darker beers may be able to go a few days longer, especially if they're higher in alcohol. Cans you don't want to store. And most of those beers are generally not extremely high alcohol anyways. Bottles will store well. Bottles in either 12 ounce or bomber size, which are 22 ounce bottles, you can store those. I've got a couple of Rodenbach sours downstairs that have been aging for upwards on 2 to 3 years now, and they'll be very nice when I decide to break them open. I've also got a couple of barley wines that are high alcohol from Firestone Brewery. But if they're bottles, they're fine. You can age those. Amount of time, sometimes they will actually tell you on the bottle how long you can age that beer.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
What's come to us at this point in the craft brewery experience. Some you can age upwards of a year. If you're 8%, 9%, 10% alcohol, you get over that, you're pushing it. But your bigger alcohols will last a bit longer. Right next to my desk, where I'm sitting in my office, I have the 2019 Sam Adams Utopias, which is their biannual liqueur concoction that is 28% alcohol. Underneath that one, I have my 2017 Utopias, which is also 28% alcohol. They cannot sell them.
What, 28%?
Yeah.
Well, that's not a beer.
They are basically a cognac tasting liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a variety of different beers aged in different types of liquor barrels, and they keep blending different beers into it, aging it in different barrels for different times. And so it takes several years for them to create these concoctions, and then they're put out. They can only be sold in stores that sell hard alcohol because of the alcohol content.
Right.
You couldn't go to a beer and wine store and buy the Utopias.
Right.
You have to go.
Okay.
To an actual liquor store.
Okay. All right, Tim.
To give you an idea, the 2017 cost me $200. The 2019...
Wait, $200 for what?
I will send you a picture.
For a beer?
It's the container is styled in a vat.
Well, no wonder you're back at work. Oh my God! And you got a second job. What? Oh my Lord! I hope the hell it's worth it, dear Lord. All right, listen, Tim. I'm a little stuck on time here, because I got to get this out. But your assignment is I'm going to have a homework assignment that I want to get from you. And what I would like for you to do, I don't know that I can get to any local breweries or anything like that. But I wonder, knowing the size of the craft brews that are at Cappy's on Route 114, Can you recommend something that I can try that is certainly not $200 a frickin' bottle, but maybe something along the lines, you know, of $10 for four? Can you recommend a craft beer that I can try so that next time I can get back to you and we can compare and contrast?
Sure. Yeah. Now, what flavor do you want it? Do you want a pilsner? Do you want a fruity beer? Do you want a porter? Do you want a stout?
I think a stout. Let's start with a stout.
All right, we'll start with the documentation. I know you're a Guinness guy, and that's why you're saying stout. But I will pick out a stout for you to try.
Okay.
And I will leave it on your doorstep.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to go okay. That's even better. All right. Yeah. Okay. And you know what? I'll just add it to your paycheck. That's all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rick, you may as well make it a deduction from my
Okay. I know. That's right. It's costing you. Hey, Tim, this is great. It's a little levity. We need this in the current situation. I really appreciate it. And for God's sakes, you and Medium, stay safe.
Well, so far we are, and we're doing our social distancing. I'm in one room and she's in another.
I got the same. Well, that happened. I hate to tell you, but it didn't take the coronavirus for that to be in my house. But,
I hope Martha doesn't hear that.
Okay. All right, that's it. Let's get out of this thing before I get in more trouble. That's the Beer Pod with Tim Kearns. Once again, this is MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore. Thank you for being with us. Bye-bye.
All right, Rick Moore from MSO News Sports. We're wrapping it up. We have gone long, but I want to close with a little clip we ran earlier this week in North Shore Today about social distancing from a social distancing expert, Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry, take it away.
Hello, I'm Larry David. Obviously, somebody put me up to this because it's generally not the kind of thing I do. But I basically want to address the idiots out there. And you know who you are. You're going out. I don't know what you're doing. You're socializing too close. It's not good. You're hurting old people like me. Well, not me. I have nothing to do with you. I'll never see you. But, you know, other old people who might be your relatives. Who the hell knows? But the problem is you're passing up a fantastic opportunity, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to stay in the house, sit on the couch, and watch TV. I mean, I don't know how you're passing that up. Well, maybe because you're not that bright. But here it is. Go home, watch TV. That's my advice to you. You know, if you've seen my show, nothing good ever happens going out of the house. You know that. There's just trouble out there. It's not a good place to be. So stay home and you know, don't see anyone. Except maybe if there's a plumbing emergency, let the plumber in and then, you know, wipe everything down after he leaves. But that's it. Okay.
That's Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm, along with Tim Kearns, Eric Smith, Kim Driscoll, Sheriff Kevin Coppinger, and Rick Moore. I'm Bill Newell. Thanks for joining us on Connections. Have a safe weekend. And yes, social distance. Nothing good happens when you go out.